You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of October 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
I've never said I'm a perfect person, nor pretended to be someone that I'm not. I've said and done things I regret, and the words released on this more than a decade-old video are one of them. Anyone who knows me knows these words don't reflect who I am. I said it, I was wrong, and I apologize.
Donald Trump's uncharacteristic apology languishes unaccepted by many people he's supposed to be leading. Can he become a Republican president without the Republican Party? My guests Rosemary Hollis and Roger Boyes will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including whether or not Trump's campaign and one or two other recent developments suggest a wider global crisis of political leadership, how much mileage there is in moralizing at Russia about its role in Syria's war, and has the Chancellor of Germany become Europe's de facto leader because of Angela Merkel, or does that title now just go with the job? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Rosemary Hollis, Professor of International Politics at City University London, and Roger Boyes, Diplomatic Editor of The Times. Welcome both. Now, first of all, if the Republican Party has not formally thrown its orange nominee, Donald Trump, under the bus, it has, in the last 24 hours, ushered him conspicuously in the direction of speeding traffic. House Speaker Paul Ryan declared that he would not defend Trump any further, not quite the most emphatic of the many desertions by Republicans over the last few days, but the highest profile. Trump has responded with a series of online outbursts increasingly resembling the transcript of a man unaware that he has been ejected from the bar and is now arguing with an empty car park. Rosemary, first of all, do we get the impression that the Republican Party has pretty much written off this presidential election?
Yes, but what astonishes me is that for months now, the commentators in the United States and indeed over in the UK have been talking about the car crash that is inevitably coming for the Republican Party as the nomination devolved to Trump. And they couldn't do, the party couldn't do anything to reverse it. They couldn't regather, regroup. And I think Paul Ryan's decision now is sort of the worst of all worlds because he's going to try and shore up the Congress, the Republican representation in the Congress, in order to stymie Hillary Clinton, who presumably he would prefer to win than Trump. But that effectively turns him and the Republican Party into a pretty poor proposition for any voter.
Roger, Rosemary there raises a point which I've been becoming increasingly curious about. When we think of Paul Ryan and other, I guess, establishment Republicans, given their choice, regardless of what they might say in public, deep down where they live, who do you think they actually want to become the next president?
Well, I mean, there is, of course, this huge residue of distaste for Hillary. And this has been quite a unifying factor within the party for quite a while. Her negatives are still, her negative polling is still very high, although it's going down slightly. But on the whole, people are not warming to her. And Trump remains the candidate of change. Now, so, you know, so all of these are basics that haven't changed. And Paul Ryan, people will end up hating Paul Ryan because he's basically announced a civil war within the party. And and guess what? If Trump loses, Ryan will take the fall. So it's there's no peaceful solution. But all I can see is that there's quite a lot of money still flowing into the Trump campaign. I mean, more than was needed at the beginning. Now there's quite a lot flowing in. And there's this incredibly unpredictable electorate, which is not being picked up necessarily by pollsters. So all of this gives hope the Republicans to carry on. And that's why I think we shouldn't write him off.
Rosemary, and again, this is me asking my guests to inhabit the mind of a senior establishment Republican at this point, which is tricky for me, certainly. But were you such an office holder, why would you not ditch Trump at this point? Even if you're thinking about it in terms of ruthless political calculation?
I think moral correctness, actually. I think, given the moral stance that a lot of them have adopted, they're very correct position on adultery and sex being much more of a taboo on the American side of the Atlantic, I think they've made a calculation about their individual careers, and they can't be seen to be condoning the kind of language that Trump bandies about. When I interrupted Roger, I was, or attempted to, I was just going to say it's so weird that it goes up and down. They go up and down in the polls depending on who is more abhorrent at that moment.
Mm. Can I just add to the Christian element? I think you'll find that will go in a cycle marked by different Sundays between now and Election Day. But basically, the Christian right believes in repentance, and that's the whole essence of the Christian right. And if Trump repents on a Thursday, by Sunday, preachers are going to be telling their folk, repentance brings forgiveness. And it's just going to be, he's got to prostrate himself now, and they will come back into the fold. Well, we will see. I'd like to see that.
Roger, you work for a newspaper, and one of the other things that started to happen in the last few days especially has been the flight of newspapers from Donald Trump, especially traditionally conservative newspapers, traditionally Republican newspapers. You will be familiar with the examples. There have been newspapers which have never endorsed a Democrat in their lives who are endorsing Hillary Clinton as an anybody but Trump candidate. In this day and age, does that damage him?
Well, no, I don't think it really does. I think Wall Street Journal, for example, classic right-wing conservative paper, has been skeptical of Trump right from the beginning because it represents the Republican establishment, which has been sniffy about Trump right from the beginning and remains so. It hasn't. It would never go. It would never back Hillary, but it. But it's in a dilemma, and we watch it anthropologically quite closely. But they're just talking to their readers, which is the Republican establishment, and we know that they don't like Trump, but we know that they might well end up voting for Trump, and so nothing changes. So and that unfortunately is the paradigm of all mainstream media. The problem is what's going on underneath. You know, the eternal blogs, the talk radio in America, what's going on there? And it moves at such a speed now, the 24-hour news cycle, that actually I'm not sure that many people will really remember these offensive comments about women. I think there might be some structural shift whereby Trump becomes a truth-sayer again, you know, and someone you respect for being authentic and all this kind of stuff.
But there's some offcuts, aren't there, that somebody has the power to reveal from...
The Apprentice.
Yes, which are very...
So rumour has it, even worse. 4 weeks is a long time in politics, of course. A final thought on this one from each of you. I'll ask you first, Rosemary. Is there a way back from where he is for Donald Trump?
Well, I subscribe to the view that he didn't expect to get this far, and that he can turn to good effect from his point of view almost any outcome.
Roger?
Yes, I mean, it's probably good for business in one way or another. He's raised his profile immensely. He's going to go on and make lots more money.
Do you think he can win the presidency?
Well, I mean, it's for Hillary to lose, isn't it? I mean, it could be that there is a new email dump, orchestrated from the Ecuadorian embassy and Julian Assange that suddenly takes the spotlight back and makes the calculation again, a little bit more in favor of Trump. Who knows?
Well, let's move along to a related subject, because Trump's bizarre campaign does prompt a number of questions, but the most obvious of them is how. Specifically, how did the party of Lincoln and Eisenhower nominate such a preposterous figure for the presidency of the mightiest nation in human history? And is it a freakish one-off, or is it part of a pattern of faltering leadership around the world? 2016 in particular has seemed like an entire year during which nobody has been watching the shop. Rosemary, I've been as baffled by this as anybody else, and you start, I think, testing yourself, or at least I have, for signs of confirmation bias or just turning into a walking stick waving middle-aged crank. But what was the world actually better run in ye olde days, do we think?
I think it goes in phases.
Or were we just less aware of what was happening than we are now?
Well, my pet theory is that every second generation needs to fight its own war in order to learn the lessons of, or the counterproductiveness of war, the destruction of war, and in order to have some kind of revolution, because war is more transformative than any peacetime arrangements. And I think we've been living in the post-World War II era, and I think that produced a certain dynamic. I think it produced the triumph of certain values, and that these have unfortunately got tired and are no longer compelling. And I think globalization, the end of the Cold War, has brought great riches for the few, which has caused great alienation at grassroots levels in many, many places. And I think in these circumstances, the challenge is beyond the kind of people who rose to the top in politics on the basis of what they were elected for in the past. I mean, I think they're careerists. They're not about statesmanship.
On that note, it does occur to me, though, and I'll put this to you, Roger, that statesmanship as we used to understand it, I guess the kind of aloof, somewhat patrician grandee who somehow knows best, you can't really be that anymore, can you? With you mentioned earlier the effect of the always-on 24-hour news media, now turbocharged even further by social media. You couldn't be anymore a Churchillian figure, could you, or an FDR kind of figure?
Well, there are different kinds of leaders, aren't there? I mean, wars call up people like Churchill and then spit him out again. You get transformational leaders who get brought up. I mean, you get Lechowenses, you get Gorbachevs, who come up specifically because there's an old order that has to be destroyed. That's a broken down old order that has to be destroyed. And you get leaders that are reacting as you are now to the sense of impotence that's come about. I think Obama has a lot to answer for, really, because he came in offering the kind of politician prince, philosopher prince kind of model of leadership, and then proved not only ineffective, that's kind of to be expected in the checks and balances system of America, but also a little bit craven, really. I mean, he standing back from and not being able, not properly projecting American power, and as a result, his heirs are now completely confused. There's a complete confusion of what the leader of the free world should actually stand for and how he or she should actually project power. And that's what's happening now. We've got a rather, you know, we've got Hillary, who's more of a follower than a leader, and we've got a guy who doesn't want to be accountable for anything in the world, even his own, bedroom. So you have these forces. You have, as Rosie said, decayed post-World War institutions. You have populists. You have the rising on the back of the downside of globalization. And you've got a political class that doesn't know where it's going. And the combination of all these makes for chaotic results. And it's not just an American problem, but it's an American problem that's infecting everybody. You know, if you were, I lived a long time in Eastern Europe, and if you were a dissident, fighting for democracy and a police state, you look to America and indeed the presidential election. In fact, they were all invited, I remember, in Warsaw and other places, to the American embassy to watch the presidential election on the television. And it was a big deal. They had to go past security police and so on. And they were there and they sat and they thought, oh my God, this is how it could be here. Well, that's gone, isn't it? That's gone. There is now no model, no norm, and no measuring rod.
And I think there's disillusionment with democracy American style. I watched in bemusement when the Americans, with the British right behind them, said they were going to introduce democracy in Iraq and seemed to have forgotten what I, when I worked in an American university, understood as the norm in American universities, that you would do politics 101 and it would tell you that democracy operates not purely on the basis of elections and majorities at elections. There's a lot more going on, and that civil society matters, and that you have to have representative institutions all the way up the system. And none of this seems to have penetrated. So I think the worst aspects of the American democratic system now rule, frankly. And the checks and balances are not sufficient if they're purely mechanical. I think there has to be a conscious effort, like we're talking about in capitalism. It doesn't just run itself. Democracy doesn't just run itself. And that is all about ideas, ideals, and active people who are acting for some objective other than just pure self-gain.
Roger, I guess a media-related question to close this section of the discussion, because it's another thought that occurs to me about how much more difficult leadership now becomes when the boundaries in which public discourse is conducted have either expanded or been abolished altogether. But if you reach a point which is happening and is accelerating, in which a plurality of your electorate and its media unmoors itself from reality, does that make leadership still possible?
Well, it makes tribal leadership possible, and that's what's happening. Basically, what Trump has done is gathered a tribe. He communicates almost exclusively with his tribe. There's no sense in any of these debates that he's trying to reach out to some kind of middle ground of voter out there somewhere. He's talking to a very specific group of people. And that's what the new media environment has created. It's created a channel of communication between a leader, you know, like in the old hunter-gatherer days, which would always be a big man, you know, and we won't go into details about how big Donald is. But anyway, he seems to follow that pattern. And that's the way it's going. It's kind of, you know, it's like the whole world is becoming balkanized.
Well, on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Rosemary Hollis and Roger Boyce. Coming up next, the increasingly vociferous accusations of Russian war crimes in Syria.
Monocle's summer travel-themed sister publication, The Escapist, is back for a second outing. Printed in the same compact form as our winter forecast, it takes you to 10 lesser-known cities around the world, with sunny stories to tell. And here's the Monocle team to guide you on your way.
Meanwhile, I went on a road trip from France's Atlantic coast to its Mediterranean one, from Biarritz to Marseille via the Pyrenees, to encounter open roads, grueling Tour de France climbs, an amusement park run by a psychiatric hospital, and strange modernist palaces in a Jag.
Elsewhere in the magazine, we look at three retailers investing in innovative brick-and-mortar spaces in Bangkok, Toronto, and Tokyo, and announce the winners of our restaurant awards, the 50 best dishes and dining rooms we tried in 2016.
The Escapist is on newsstands now. Get yours today or become a subscriber at monocle.com and never miss out.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Rosemary Hollis and Roger Boyce. Now, little that Russia has done in Syria has suggested much in the way of regard for what anyone thinks of its conduct. However, Russia's recent enthusiastic complicity in the demolition of what remained of Aleppo has begun to attract reviews sufficiently negative that even Moscow has noticed. President François Hollande of France has suggested that Russia has committed war crimes. This prompted the cancellation of a visit to Paris by President Vladimir Putin, and Hollande's sentiments have today been echoed by UK Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. Rosemary, first of all, on that basic suggestion, is there a case against Russia?
I'm sure there's a case against Russia that could be brought by those countries that are members of the court, but it smacks of that's about they've just thought of another thing that they could do without much hope that it's going to change the situation.
This is to borrow the phraseology of yes, Prime Minister, all support short of actual help, isn't it?
Or the negative version thereof, yes.
But I think it's quite a useful exercise just to make a list of the different things that they've done, you know, shooting up aid convoys and, you know, hitting hospitals, the double tap, you know, and hitting rescue workers. And I don't think there's any... of course, a normal court in a normal situation would certainly consider these things to be crimes, at least complicity insofar as they guarantee the airspace for Syrian helicopters to roll their barrel bombs out on civilians and so on. These are crimes against humanity and crimes against war. There's no doubt about it. But as Rosie says, it doesn't really change anything.
Not on the ground, and it's perceived as a sort of Western game. So what good is this to us?
Boris Johnson, Rosemary, suggested that Russia runs the risk of becoming a pariah nation. That being the case, though, there is, and I'm sure this has occurred to many people, there is one significant thing that the world could hang over Russia, which might actually have some domestic political impact on Vladimir Putin, which is the 2018 World Cup. Should countries now start saying they won't be going?
They might mention Qatar in that list as well. And, you know, how much distaste and... distancing can go on because of what others do without hypocrisy kicking in. Actually, I would be quite interested to know, though, from Roger, because he will have been observing this much more closely than I, how the Russians proceeded in Chechnya and what they called victory there. And is there any resemblance to what they seem to fancy would be victory in Syria? Because I think it's a hollow victory if you simply try to smash your enemy. And I was afraid that British and American strategy for ISIS was similar, that let's kill the bastards. And then what? Oh, rebuilding? Finding a replacement? Oh, well, the important thing was to get rid of the problem. Not create a new one. So how did they get rid of the problem in Chechnya?
Well, they haven't really got rid of the problem, but they did bomb it flat. And then they put their man in charge, the very strange Mr. Kadyrov, along with his private zoo, and who now swears absolute loyalty to Putin. And then they rebuilt it. So it's now, of course, complete... full of marble mosques, and it's run as a loyal Muslim republic. And he goes regularly to Moscow to swear loyalty to Putin. So all they've done, but it was much easier. It's much easier. There's only one
because
city.
Well,
because
small.
Grozny was just one. Chechnya is basically, in military terms, just the city of Grozny. Whereas, you know, you can wipe Aleppo flat, and it's not, which I'm afraid they're trying to do. And what have you done? Yeah, you've done nothing. And Chechnya, by the way, is also the source now of a massive flow of jihadists and so on into the Middle East. So
when, though, would the tide turn against Russia rather than Western Europe or the United States in terms of the jihadi anger? Or is it not going to turn against the Russians?
Well, it is a little bit, but in the area of the Caucasus where they're not bothered. I mean, where they've got it more or less under, they've put their placemen in charge. You know, the FSB is very active and has little hit squads and death squads and so on to get rid of anyone they spot, and which is basically shielded from the world view. So it's their backyard. They treat it like their backyard. So, yes, there are jihadist factories there, burning with resentment about Aleppo.
We should move on finally tonight to our last topic, because while it may seem that yet another power vacuum is about the last thing the Western world wishes to contemplate right now, the next German election is probably less than a year away. And for more than a decade, the chancellorship of Angela Merkel has been one reliably fixed point amid the chaos of current events. But what if she decides not to seek a fourth term, or seeks one and doesn't get it? Does the title of de facto leader of Europe pass automatically to her successor? Rosemary, exactly that question. Is the Chancellor of Germany Europe's leader because of the job Angela Merkel has done, or does it just go with the territory at this point?
Well, I'm very struck by something that was said by some EU officials when I was giving a talk about Brexit and what it might mean for the Middle East. And my audience suddenly included a lot of, this was in Jerusalem, a lot of European diplomats that I was delighted to see in one way. But the perspective that I was hearing from Germany was, we do not want to be alone with leadership in Europe. Please, what a shame that we haven't got the British with whom we agree on a lot of things, but tempering this perception that we're running the show. And so I think the Germans themselves are reluctant leaders. And I think Angela Merkel was a phenomenon for a lot of reasons that have not to do with the chancellorship.
Reluctant leaders or not, Roger, I think few people would disagree that Germany very much is in that position. And as Rosemary says, possibly more so once the UK leaves. But who else is there?
Well, there's Helmut Kohl. He's still not dead. He could come back. there isn't really. But it's not, I think you're thinking about it in the wrong way, really. That's to say that it's about the balance of forces between Germany and France and who takes over the leadership of post-Brexit Europe. And it's within that. It's so somewhere between the French election next year and the German election next year, something will be clear about which country actually sets the tone of European future European developments. So that's less about person. It's a very German answer because it doesn't involve personalities. But as for Merkel, I don't know. There was a biography, I mean, there's been zillions of biographies, but there was one a couple of years ago which said, I don't want ever to reign for or serve or rule for 10 years because I saw what happened to Helmut Kohl. You know, after 10 years, he started to fall apart.
I think all power goes to their heads.
Yeah. You know, viz Blair, you know, or Viz.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's not good for people. I do think the Americans have had this about right. I think 8 years will do.
Well, she's now on year 11. So
it's remarkable how well she's done in that sense.
Yeah. But it's the sense of duty. It's the vicar's daughter syndrome, you know, and as we call it.
And I don't think May will go last for 11 years.
No, so there's a question of really whether she will do it herself, whether she will step down herself or not. But she might consider herself to be indispensable. It's possible, in which case she might then win it. And what we will see is as we always see in these cycles, is a completely deteriorating condition of German leadership and embarrassing crises following embarrassing crises.
And they'll have to take blame that had previously been dumped on Britain.
Well, that's something for them to look forward to.
Yeah.
On that optimistic note, for our German listeners, that is all we have time for on today's show. Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Gail Barnier. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. Thanks to our guests, Rosemary Hollis and Roger Boys. There's music next at 1900. It's Monocle's dedicated design show, Section D. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, though, I'm Andrew Muller, thanks for listening and goodbye.